Hello and welcome to Positive Leadership, the podcast that helps you grow as an individual, as a leader, and a global citizen. I'm Jean-Philippe Courtois.
Yeah, the question we have to ask ourselves as people who build technology is, are we doing the best job that we possibly can to build technology in a way where, you know, 40 years from now, our children and our grandchildren will look back and say, wow, this was beneficial. This mattered. This made all of these things that we care about with justice and the human condition better, not worse. And like, we better get it right.
My guest today is a leader who thinks deeply about how technology will affect people, communities, and society. He's a very dear colleague of mine, sitting with me on the Microsoft Senior Leadership Team, or CTO, Chief Technology Officer, Kevin Scott. Kevin plays a key role in shaping Microsoft AI strategy. He grew up in a rural town of Gladys, Virginia, a place that's been and will continue to be disrupted by emerging technologies, and he's very mindful about the potential impact of AI on the workers of towns like Gladys. He's the host of Brilliant Beyond the Tech podcast, and recently published Reprogramming the American Dream, From Rural America to Silicon Valley, Making AI Service All, which I highly recommend. It was an enormous pleasure to sit down with Kevin to talk about technology innovation process and its role in serving the public interest and to dig into his thinking around responsible AI, what it looks like and how it works in practice. Hope you enjoyed the episode. Here's Kevin. In a Positive Leadership podcast, one of the first things that we get people to do actually is to reflect on the moments that have shaped them into the person and leader that they are today. So I'd like to start at the very beginning of your story back in Gladys, Virginia. What was it like for you as a kid growing up? Who or what was the largest influence on you and your core beliefs, Kevin?
The biggest influence on my ethos and values were my family.
Yeah.
We certainly weren't well off. Like, we were, you know, at times, like, you know, had a lot of financial difficulty, and at best, my family was always paycheck to paycheck. But, you know, I don't think we really paid much attention to that, or at least that's not the, you know, the thing that we were always talking about. My dad was a construction worker, and my mom, hustled with a bunch of little side jobs that she did. She was a tax preparer. She, ran a nursery school for the kids at church for a brief period. But like, her primary job was taking care of the family. And, you know, I just had the luxury of being around a bunch of people who were hardworking, very curious, who always worked with their hands, who were always tinkering with something, and who felt like they had an obligation to their community to do something valuable.
People who care for their community, right?
Yeah.
Who are serving others in their day-to-day lives as well.
Yeah.
So something that's important to you, I think, Kevin, is also referenced in the title of your book, is the American Dream. This idea that anyone, regardless of where they were born and what class they were born into, can attend their own version of success. And it's an idea that has served as a powerful motivation for many people in the US for many years and around the world as well. So did the American Dream seem like something that was within their grasp?
Both my parents and I believed when I was growing up, and, you know, I still believe this, that like, if you go figure out some way to be valuable to your fellow human beings, that you try to understand what they want and need, and then you go do work and work as hard as you possibly can to try to meet those needs of your fellow human beings, that good things will happen to you. And it doesn't mean that, you know, like you, I tell this to my kids all the time, like, CTO of Microsoft, there's so much luck involved in that. Like, that's a crazy thing to try to fixate on and plan for. But I would have been okay no matter what my outcome was by just applying this, you know, set of ideas that, you know, like I can work hard, try to discover, you know, what's valuable to do and then going to do that thing. And it really isn't a promise. And like, it was kind of implicit in the way that my parents talk to me about this and in how they acted. It's like you just have to go do the work and like you got to go grind through it. And you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And it's just it's maybe even more valuable to do something and fail and learn something from the failure and then get up and go again as it is succeeding. Like sometimes success teaches you nothing.
Yeah, absolutely. So in a way, a very much hard work ethics and also almost like an entrepreneurship mindset, the way you describe it actually, Kevin.
Yeah. I didn't even know the word entrepreneur when I was growing up, but like I think that's what I was surrounded by, a bunch of entrepreneurs. Yeah.
So early on, obviously, as a child at one point, you've been saving up little money you could, and you bought your first computer, Radio Shack Color Computer 2, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
And I think it was a huge deal, a big deal for you personally. But actually, as an undergrad, you studied English, and you kept it as your minor for college and computer science as your major. You actually almost went, I think people don't know that, for an English PhD. So what happened? What made you decide between mastering programming versus mastering your native language, English?
I mean, so part of it's pragmatic, right? Like I was constantly trying to figure out how I was going to support myself and support my family because I'd gotten a scholarship that partially covered the cost of going to school, but didn't completely. So I had student loans. I was on my own from financially, part of that was my decision. And part of it was, my parents' financial circumstances. Like I just had to take care of myself. And eventually, like I had to take care of my entire family. And so part of it was a pragmatic thing. Like I enjoyed both equally. And so, and I think that's a tremendous luxury because sometimes it's hard to even find the one thing that you really enjoy. And so I picked computer science. And the story that I told myself about picking computer science is like, there's a way to do computer science that is artful, that is, grounded in the humanities, and that I wasn't really forsaking anything by making this choice.
So I think you wrote your first line of code back in 1983. Interesting enough, it was the year, Kevin, I joined a French software startup company. I was doing modest because I was not good at that, some basic programming on an Apple II.
Nice.
What would be your advice to a young 18 years old Kevin who loved to learn how to develop a piece of software without being able to go through a computer science degree? Which studies, if any, should he consider? How would you go about that today?
Yeah, I don't know whether I personally would have done anything different because young Kevin would have looked at these AI systems and would have wanted to understand what's behind the scenes of them and how they work. But you know, I think the advice that I would give people more generally is like find whatever it is that you really, really, really have a passion about that is valuable to other people and try to use these tools that you now have available to you to go do that thing. And, you know, like I have a 13-year-old and a 15-year-old who are like thinking about what it is that they want to be. And, you know, my 15-year-old daughter has wanted to be a cardiothoracic surgeon for the past year. Like it's sort of a weird, thing that she got fixated on when she was really young because she watched too much Grey's Anatomy. And she, you know, had decided that she's not a tech person, but her mind has been changed over the past few years. Like the way that she's using tools like ChatGPT and GitHub Copilot to help her solve these medical problems and healthcare problems that she's really motivated by is like quite interesting. And so like, I think that's the mindset. It's like all of these problems we need to go solve, like all of these things that matter and that are important. And we have increasingly powerful tools to go do them. And like, you don't have to be a programmer anymore to get the computer to do unbelievably powerful things for you in service of what it is you're trying to accomplish.
It reminds me of one of the episodes I had with Sal Khan, and the way, of course, he's been developing the Kamingo AI agent, who is becoming increasingly, and when you ask him the question about the future, kind of your personal tutor beyond actually just the course you are taking on. And, you know, he could even portray a day where you would say, well, you know, it could become actually a lifelong learning agent for all of us. And so we could actually, all of us, keep learning a bunch of things differently.
Yeah. And like, I think we all learn differently and we all learn at different rates. So like this idea that you could have an infinitely patient tutor that could adapt to your particular learning needs, like yes. very individually, like yep. I think is...
It's
just a really interesting, powerful idea.
I think it's a wonderful analogy. Again, just another very recent podcast visit I had with a French chef, right, in terms of cooking, called Thierry Marx, who is at least well-known in country and beyond. He's doing some amazing work as well socially. He's someone who loves about talking about this philosophy of basically learning by doing, putting his hands yeah. into the what he called the katas of cooking, the fundamentals yeah. of cooking. And this is where he grew up as a kid, actually, in the kitchens of big chiefs anyway. So a very nice analogy, which I love when it comes to AI. Let's go back to the roots of AI with Alan Turing, a pioneering figure in computer science and AI. In a seminal 1950 paper called Computing Machinery and Intelligence, he asked the following questions. Can machines think? Can machines do what we as thinking entities can do? And he said, it is possible to do a machine which will learn by experience. And obviously, we know that his work laid the foundational concept that continue to guide AI research and development today. So a lot has happened since Alan Turing, obviously, Kevin. What did you personally experience as the most stunning breakthrough?
Yeah. So when Turing wrote that paper, the term artificial intelligence hadn't been coined yet. It was 5 years later at a workshop at Dartmouth when a bunch of these mathematicians and computer scientists and information theorists sat down and said, hey, we want to build a machine that in many ways can replicate what a human brain does. And like, we're going to call this study, this new field, artificial intelligence. And we have had a really hard time over the entire history of the discipline, even defining what artificial intelligence is. And like, we've got this track record of yeah. we think that we understand what intelligence is, like what our own intelligence is. And then we go build machines to replicate some aspect of it. And as soon as we accomplish the thing, then we redefine what the, you know, the measure of intelligence is. Like we used to think that, you know, the apotheosis of human cognition are these very challenging games like chess and Go.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
in 1997, IBM built a system called Deep Blue that
right.
beat Garry Kasparov, who was the world champion chess player at the time at chess. And it was stunning. Like nobody thought it was possible. And as soon as it happened, we figured out that like, oh, this really isn't the breakthrough that is going to, you know, tip us over into, you know, this idea of artificial general intelligence. Like this solves a very narrow thing. And like, you know, funny enough, like I think chess is now like a more popular human pastime and hobby. And like you could even think about it as a sport, you know, given how competitive it is and how much joy people derive from like competing and watching the
Absolutely.
Competition.
Yeah.
Even though since 1997, there has never been a human chess player as good as a computer at playing chess. Like we just don't care anymore.
Yeah. But we keep playing.
And so,
playing.
You know, I think yes. that's a really important thing to keep in mind. And you know, to answer your exact question, like the most stunning breakthrough, I think, in my career probably like happened recently.
Really?
It was when GPT-4 finished training, and this idea that we had that you could follow a particular path of developing artificial intelligence was going to result in an AI system that was very generally useful for doing a bunch of cognitive tasks.
That was a big aha moment.
I had a strong sense that it was coming, but I didn't know it was coming this fast. And the thing doesn't think. So, like, you know, what you're going back to your Turing quote,
yeah,
he said
yeah.
two distinct things. Like, one is he's talking about thinking, and one he's talking about, you know, can we write a piece of software that emulates, you know, aspects of what our brains do? And so, absolutely, we can do the latter, but the former is like this, like, almost a philosophical thing. Like, I don't even, you know, when I say, like, hey, you know, JP, you know, do you think, like, what are you thinking about? Like, how do you think? Like, that's a very human question. And like, it's very different from what these software systems are doing.
Despite the fact that we spend so much time thinking, there's no universally accepted definition of what thinking actually is. It's a complex phenomenon that involves cognitive, emotional, and sensory process, and can be approached from different perspectives, such as philosophy and neurology, as well as software engineering. And because we don't really understand how people think, it's hard to show what actually counts as thinking. Turing's imitation game was a clever way to get around that problem. If a computer behaved as if it's thinking, it decided. Then you can assume it is. Which sounds like another thing to assume, but we do the same with people. We have no way of knowing what's going on in their heads. New AI innovations like Microsoft Copilot and GPT-4 from OpenAI appear human-like, but it's done in an entirely different way than what occurs in human mind. As Kevin says, it is not thinking. But it's clear that generative AI has emerged as a transformative force, profoundly influencing various aspects of our lives. Back just a couple of years ago, can you just allude to that? You were really an inception point of the partnership between Microsoft and OpenAI. And because back in the spring of 2018, I think when you first went down to meet them, obviously OpenAI already had a relationship with Microsoft using Azure. And you met the team, including Sam Altman and also Ilya Sutskever. What were your first impressions meeting those guys and the work they were doing at the time before ChatGPT-4, 4.5 Turbo and more coming up now?
Well, I will tell you, I was skeptical going into the meeting. Mm-hmm. And like my skepticism in general is like just a personality disorder, like not anything specific to the team. Like I'm always yeah. slightly skeptical of things that I haven't fully understand. And sometimes like I will go fully understand them and I'm still skeptical afterwards. But this was one of those rare instances where I went in and I was, yeah, you know, I've been building machine learning systems at that point since 2004. And I was not prepared to go into that meeting to have my mindset about what was possible in the next handful of years change. And I walked out of it like absolutely convinced that like we were on the cusp of something very interesting. Like we were still years away, but like, you know, they had a framework and a way of thinking about the problem that they were tackling that very scientific. Yeah, you know, there was a methodology like, you know, here's the experiment we're going to run. This is what we will learn from it. And like, this is what it will tell us about the experiment we will go run after that. And I thought we had the foundations for a partnership where, you know, we could do some valuable things for them to support like this very disciplined development of a very useful AI system. And like the way that it was going to be useful and interesting for us was that it wasn't trying to solve a narrow problem. Mm. So a lot of the AI systems before then like were built to solve a narrow problem, like play chess, predict which ad someone is going to click on. We think we're going to be able to build this system and that as a function of scale, it's going to become more broadly useful and you're going to be able to build like dozens and hundreds and thousands and, you know, millions of applications on top of it. And like as a platform company, like that's exactly the mission Microsoft has been on for, you know, almost five decades now.
For sure. I'd like to come back to your book and the role you have at Microsoft, because I think you've been always, what I got to know you, quite Skeptical, yes, but actually quite optimist as well. Someone's driving the positive side of innovation, I would say. That's also my bias, I must admit, as you know. And so, but you also experienced early on in your childhood, as you said, poverty and loss of industry in the region where you grew up. And so you understand well the need to invest in rural infrastructure. So let's imagine that today, Kevin, you are now in charge of shaping the social and economic development of Virginia that you know so well. What should you do, right, to transform the lives of the people in those rural communities, to reshape the traditional sectors like construction, textile, furniture, agriculture, and more? In other words, how would you reprogram the American dream in your home city?
Yeah, I think the thing that you should do, and this is a set of things that we ought to be thinking about doing fairly broadly, actually, not just in the rural parts of the United States, but in the developing world and, you know, in all parts of the industrialized world as well. Job one is you actually have to have the infrastructure in place to support people using AI tools to solve the problems that they want to solve. So
right.
Part of it is like, do you have a platform available? Is it open? Like, is it getting cheaper and more powerful over time? Like, is it, you know, can you operate it freely across global boundaries? You know, it means some very basic things. Like one of the struggles that folks in my community have is the internet just doesn't work well.
Yeah.
So my mom and brother live near a local telephone building, like the Exchange for Gladys, and they have very good internet. Mm. And my uncle, who lives 3 miles away, has 300 kilobit per second internet,
wow,
which was great in 1990, and is pretty horrendous now.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you can't leverage AI if you can't connect to AI. And then, like, I think a bunch of the stuff you need to go do is like really educate people to be entrepreneurs in a sense. So how do you take young people and expose them to like this full palette of tools that they have to use, and like help them think critically about what the interesting problems there are in the world that they could put those tools to use solving? It's a very different educational paradigm than the one that we've had since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, where it was like, you know, you human being like need to, you know, learn these basic skills. You need to be literate. You need to know a little bit of math. You need to have structure in your life where you can get up in the morning and like go do something for this number of hours and, you know, work in teams and understand hierarchies and like all of this stuff. Like that was very industrial revolution sort of learning.
Completely.
And that's not really what we need right now.
So it's both infrastructure, it's skilling, it's actually lowering the bar of accessing as well, not just freely, but also I think the level of confidence, right? Because there's a lot of fear in many countries. I travel the world as well for a company, and I can still see a lot of confusion, fear, anxiety in just getting access to AI. And so I think there's a lot to be done there as well in terms of education.
Yeah. If you look over, you know, decade time horizons, you know, we've got some very challenging things happening in the world.
Yeah.
Like you have a warming climate, which is going to impose a whole bunch of structural changes on the world. Like we basically have designed a world for one temperature regime and we're about to enter another one. And like we have lots of work to go do to adapt to that and to like try to, you know, engineer and
redesign
energy economy that won't make the temperature regime worse than it's going to be.
Yeah.
But you know, maybe the one that we don't talk a lot about is demographic change. So, you know, almost everywhere in the industrialized world, we are either in population decline or the population growth is decelerating, and you can sort of see a point near in the future where you're going to tip into deceleration. And so, like, if you think about, like, in our lifetime, like, this isn't, you know, like an imaginary time horizon where I'm worrying on the behalf of, you know, my children, which I do, but like, we can also worry on behalf of ourselves.
Yeah.
These demographic changes in the world will mean that you just don't have a big enough workforce to go do the work of the world unless you have major breakthroughs in productivity. And major breakthroughs in technology, in productivity, mean technology. And so whether it's AI or something else, like something has to happen, or you know, we will have a profoundly different world than the one that we occupy right now. And like AI is currently
the best shot
on goal for productivity that we have.
Yeah, no, I fully agree with you. It's fascinating to see all that happening, hopefully in our lives, as you say, Kevin. So I'd like to shift gears a bit, and you actually alluded to the times we are going through right now in 24. This is actually the biggest election year in history, as you know, with countries representing more than half of the world's population, like 4 billion people are going to send their citizens to the polls. So, you know, I was rereading a book I got from Bill Gates, of course, our founder and first CEO of the company. He wrote this book in 1985 called The Road Ahead. He said, "We don't have option of turning away from the future. No one gets to vote on whether technology is going to change our lives." So, Kevin, do you agree that no one gets to vote for using AI in their lives?
Oh, they totally get to vote. We get to do what we do because society has given us permission. We don't have a right to do what we do.
We don't.
We currently have permission to do what we do. And like the permission can be revoked if we do it irresponsibly, if we are not listening very carefully to what people are telling us. And like that is, you know, if you have that mindset, like you basically have more fluid voting, because before you have to have like extreme votes, like people are voting every day by telling you what they do and don't like. And if you're listening and adapting what you're doing, you know, hopefully you get into an equilibrium that people are happy with, that they feel confident about and hopeful about. But you can't just jam stuff into society like that. It really doesn't in the limit work that way.
Yeah, I fully agree with you, Kevin. I was really interested to listen to the State of the Nation pitch by your president, Joe Biden. He said, "We must address the growing concern about AI-generated voice impersonations. I propose a ban on the misuse of this technology to create deceptive voice recordings. Our responsibility is to manage the risk associated with AI, especially in areas like society, economy, and national security." So how should governments, in the first place, and as we just starting to talk about that, tech companies like Microsoft and our peers, embrace what we've called responsible AI? What does it mean, actually, if you could share your thinking in a practical way?
You know, since responsible AI is sort of like responsible governance or, generally accepted accounting practices or it is about saying this is what we believe responsible AI means. It is being transparent, like in the saying. So like publish what your guidelines are and then having a set of processes and controls inside of your company that make sure that you adhere to the standard, and then being willing to engage with stakeholders about evolving the standard and like having some degree of auditability of your processes for adhering to it. And so, you know, I think every company that is developing and deploying this technology needs a framework like this.
Yep.
The same way that, you know, you've got board audit committees and like you have outside auditors that are looking at your books. Yeah, when a thing gets important enough, like you need some kind of framework so that collectively everybody can believe that you're doing the thing right. And so, you know, some of the stuff that I think the president called for is like perfectly reasonable. Like one of the things that we've been very, very hesitant about, and like we've had technology that can do interesting things with voices for a while. And like for a while, we have chosen not to deploy that because the risk of people using that in fraudulent ways, in ways that far outweigh the benefits, seems, you know, like something we need to think carefully about. And maybe at some point you will do it because, yeah, there are also positive uses for the technology. Like one of the things that we've been doing in my team is there's this neurodegenerative disease called ALS that will ultimately cause, among other things, people to literally lose their voice. And so we have been using this technology to archive people's voices. So before they lose the ability to speak, we get enough of a set of samples from their actual speech so that you could have an AI system give them their voice back.
Which is wonderful.
And so like that is an unbelievably powerful and beneficial thing. And so
yeah.
With all of this stuff, it's about the balances. It's like, what yes. good does it enable? Like, what bad does it enable? And like, how do you make sure that the good far outweighs the bad? And that like, when the bad is really bad, that you can, prevent that from happening and very, very, very quickly detect and mitigate misuse.
No, I'm with you. I'm with you. And I think, obviously, not just as a company, but with the industry and others, I think I've never seen my 40 years plus in tech. I mean, as much as I would say urgency coming from government themselves, actually, to regulate. It's happening in Europe, it's happening in the US, it's happening in Asia. And I think we are all in around the table to make sure we agree on those guiding principles and then implement some tools and processes. And you know that well, Kevin, because you're also the head of a responsible AI office with some of your peers at Microsoft to make sure that in our own ways of building AI tools, we do it as in a much responsible way. And I think that's maybe, I don't know if you want to touch a bit on that, on the way our customers can benefit from those practices as well.
We're a platform company. And so wherever possible, when we're building tools and infrastructure to help ourselves build products and to launch them and operate them, safely and efficiently and all the other attributes you want of products, like we try to make that infrastructure available to customers. And so we have an increasingly sophisticated set of infrastructure that we're offering in Azure to help people build and operate AI-powered products responsibly. And increasingly, the tools that you use for RAI are powered by AI themselves, which is like one of the really interesting things. The more powerful AI gets, the more powerful your RAI infrastructure gets. One thing that I will say, like, since we're talking about policy and regulation, is that there is also like, the same way that when you're developing a technology, there's this balance between, benefits and harms that you're trying to weigh. There's also like positive and negative for regulation. So like if you regulate too aggressively and too early, like you may curtail the development of technology that can be unbelievably beneficial. And so, the thing that I think, again, this is all about societal equilibrium here. Like, we have to do what we're doing in a way where we have enough societal trust where we can develop the technology and let people lay their hands on it and evaluate whether it's good or bad themselves so that we can inform the regulation that actually has to happen.
Yeah.
If you don't do that, like you're kind of regulating into a vacuum. You're sort of imagining what a future, might be, and like you don't even know that it exists. And you sort of risk two things, like, regulating the wrong thing. So like you think very thoughtfully about regulation, you pass something and it doesn't produce the effect you intended, or, like you inhibit something that could be very, very valuable.
I would say, as usual with any innovation, but really with this one in particular, it's really a balancing act between policies at a highest level, but also then technology innovation, processes, and people. We don't dig into that, but obviously people are critical to the way you do and develop AI.
Yeah, people is the right thing. Like, honestly, like that's the most important thing. So it's more important than the regulation. It's more important than like, the implementation details. It's like if you are not doing something that is valuable, that is serving the public interest, that is like making like everyone's lives net better, then what are you doing? Like you're honestly wasting your time. Like you don't need regulation. You need to wake up and stop doing what you're doing.
Okay, that's a foundational principle. Now I'd like to shift gears a little bit and use one of the favorite quotes he has, many of our manager, common manager, Satya, a poem. Satya likes poems, Kevin, as you know. And there's one quote from this Austrian poet called Rainer Maria Rilke. He once wrote that the future enters into us in order to transform itself in us long before it happens. So, Kevin, is AI entering into us? Is AI entering into humans for a better world or for a dystopian world?
obviously, when a technology emerges, it absolutely changes us. Changes us, I think, in pretty deep ways. Like if you just imagine you and I, for instance, like how we process the world and see the world is deeply influenced by like a whole bunch of technologies that have emerged over the past 40 years. Yeah. Like I had a my great grandmother who passed away many years ago, lived to be 100 years old. And like she was born in the 19th century and like lived through the first stages of the like the first internet bubble. And so like she went from a world that had no electricity, no cars, no airplanes. You know, she didn't have indoor plumbing. She was in, you know, this sort of barely industrialized, you know, kind of Victorian world when she was born. And by the end, you know, like we had airplanes, space travel, satellites, internet, mobile phones. And so like technology has an extraordinary impact on not just how we live our lives, but like how we sort of perceive reality. Whether that's good or bad is up to us. So it's choices that we make about how we use the technology, like what we decide to put it to. And I think, you know, if you look over the long arc of history, like there's this, it has been by and large positive. And in a sense, like it has to be, otherwise you have no progress over very long periods of time. Like if you choose the wrong path every time, like you will collapse. And so, yeah, we occasionally choose wrong things and then we course correct. And like, you know, we've been building to, you know, a world that is so much more prosperous than the world that you or I were born into, or the world that, you know, certainly that my great grandmother was born into.
I love us to pursue, because we're almost coming to an end, Kevin, with more positive scenarios in mind. You mentioned already a couple of great examples like ALS. You know, I could refer as well to eyesight. I could refer to a wonderful visit in India 2-3 weeks ago. And, you know, this is a wonderful multilingual platform they built, and Microsoft Research actually has been partnering with them to enable they have 270 languages, 22 officials, enabling a farmer in a remote village to talk his language, to be not just translated to English and Hindi, but to connect and using a Copilot like ChatGPT interface to get access for the first time ever to the public subsidies he was actually able to get in his life. And it can apply to farming, education. What are you the most excited about in regards to application of Gen AI when it comes to the most positive breakthrough for the society?
Yeah, I think there's so much stuff. That one that you mentioned in particular, the pattern, I think is really interesting. So one of the things that modern generative AI ought to be very good at is helping everyone navigate the complexity of the world.
Yeah.
So, you know, the example that you gave is a good one. Like we've been doing some work with an organization in the United States called Share Our Strength, which whose mission is to feed kids. Yeah, it's just sort of amazing, like how much childhood hunger there is and like what the knock-on effects of childhood hunger are. Like a tremendous amount of what gets diagnosed as ADHD is actually just kids being hungry. And like when you're hungry, you can't focus, you can't learn, and like, you know, just sort of becomes a snowball effect in people's lives. And so the thing that we're doing with Share Our Strength is like we're trying to figure out how to use generative AI to help people navigate the entitlement programs that already exist, that already are funded. The money has been appropriated and it's sitting there unspent because people either aren't aware of it or can't navigate the bureaucracy to sign themselves up for it. And this ought to be a great thing for generative AI to help with. And like we're working and like I think that is a pattern is really, really extraordinarily powerful. I think educational equity is another thing. Like I look at, you know, my daughter goes to a very good school here in Silicon Valley with excellent teachers. It's my school did, you know, the best that it could do back in the 70s and 80s, rural Central Virginia. But like, if I look at my school versus my daughter's school, like not even a comparison.
Yeah.
And you know, the thing that I think AI could do is like close that gap to try to make a higher quality of education and learning and enablement more equally available, not just across the United States, but across the world. You know, and then like I think there's some truly exciting stuff happening right now where the fundamental pattern driving progress in AI right now, this notion of self-supervised learning, that you can transform compute and data and increasingly just compute into AI systems that can solve very complicated problems, is applicable to more than just language. And so we're doing some really fascinating work at Microsoft Research on how you can apply these techniques to physics and chemistry and biology to help with, you know, building the next electrolyte for energy storage, or you know, designing a therapeutic molecule that will cure disease. And I think it's underappreciated because they're more complicated for a layperson to perceive what the progress is versus, you know, what's happening with language agents or, you know, linguistic based agents. It's like the progress is extraordinary. So like these are not little steps we're making. Like they are just unbelievable. So in some cases, like the biggest jumps forward in progress that we've ever seen. And so it's just it's an exciting, exciting, exciting time.
Well, I share the excitement with you. Of course, I'm lucky enough being part of Microsoft to see some amazing, mind-blowing developments going on. Finishing last couple of questions, Kevin, with even more positive stories, because that's the core, the spirit of my podcast, as you know. I know that with your wife, Shannon Hunt Scott, you started the Scott Foundation back in 2014 with a desire to give back to the Silicon Valley community where they work and raise their family. I think initial focus of the foundation was on supporting leading-edge organizations addressing critical needs such as childhood hunger, early childhood education, women, girls in technology. So what is it that you and your wife are the most proud of? And do you see yourself more and more involved in such foundations like our friend Bill has done for the last few decades of his life now?
I think what Bill has done with the Gates Foundation is really extraordinary. The work that they've done in public health is just extraordinary. And like they have chosen, like, here are these acute problems that are not getting solved fast enough, that don't have a natural mechanism to get solved. So like if something doesn't change, like they're going to be like just as bad or worse, you know, 50 years from now. And so the thing that we focus on at the Scott Foundation is trying to identify and relieve structural poverty cycles. So things that lock people into intergenerational poverty. And the reason that that's our focus is because both my wife and I grew up, you know, not terribly privileged. I mean, we had some privilege, you know, because even though, you know, my dad went bankrupt a couple of times and, you know, like we had a lot of, you know, financial hardship to go deal with, you know, we're more privileged than someone who was, you know, born, you know, in equatorial Africa, for instance, in the 1970s. So like, I think you always have to appreciate, you know, what you have. But I think both my wife and I, in a sense, look at ourselves and we're like, wow, like there are a handful of things that happened to us that if they hadn't have happened, like we would have had very, very, very different lives. And the point of the foundation is like, what can you do to go engineer a helping hand, to go engineer some of the good luck that my wife and I had so that you don't have to have so much left to chance in getting people to like snap out of a poverty cycle. And we try to invest in organizations that are entrepreneurial. So who, you know, where you they're thinking about how you can take an investment and with leverage, you know, with tools like AI, for instance, like you can go tackle a problem and like get a big benefit.
A big impact, yeah. In the positive leadership philosophy, you know, we learn how to be self-aware, and how to build our self-confidence, but also to build our own positivity, which I think is super important, by the way, in the way we show up, in the way we connect with people. So what are your daily routines, Kevin, or maybe habits you have from time to time to grow your positive leadership with your colleagues, customers, and all the people you connect with in your lives?
I think it is really important for your own positivity and the positivity that you project in the world to be grateful.
Yes.
Like to just, no matter how crappy your day is, to ground yourself in like, what's one thing that I can be grateful for today? And the reason I think it's so important is because once you start feeling gratitude, there's almost a snowball effect to it. Like once you've felt the first thing you're grateful for, it's easy to see all of the other things that you should be grateful for. And it helps you be humbler. I think it's one of the, you know, foundations of having compassion in your life, of being able to put yourself in someone else's shoes and like not feeling what they're feeling, but to, you know, just try to understand what their point of view is and like why they might be, you know, doing what they're doing. Like even if, you know, your knee jerk reaction is like, you know, this is irritating. Like there's always a reason for everything. So like just a little bit of gratitude can go an awfully long way.
Kevin is so right. A little bit of gratitude can go an enormous way. Appreciating the good things in our lives cultivates positive emotions such as joy, happiness, and optimism. There's so much research that says a gratitude practice makes you enjoy life more. It's such a good idea to incorporate it into your daily routines or rituals. For example, you could start or end each meal with a moment of gratitude, or you could place visual reminders of gratitude around your home or your workspace. This could be a gratitude jar where you drop in notes of appreciation, a gratitude board where you pin up pictures or quotes that inspire gratitude, or just simply a sticky note in your mirror reminding you to be thankful. I mean, you're still a young man, at least relative to me. Everything is relative in life, I think. And so it's a bit early to be thinking about your legacy, but perhaps what story would you like people to tell about you, Kevin, in the future?
I don't know. Like, honestly, I'm deeply uncomfortable with anybody paying any attention at all to what I'm doing. Like, what I would like is... I would like the opportunity to work with people who care about what it is that they're doing. Yeah. And like the thing often that I'm, you know, proudest about, I just got a note this morning from, you know, a friend, like a someone that I hired like many, like 19 years ago, actually. And like they sent me a note on the 19th anniversary of their start date at like, you know, this thing that we were both doing back then, and like thanked me. And, you know, like I should be thanking them, because the thing that makes me feel the best about what I've done is like having some tiny little impact, a positive impact on someone's career.
Yeah.
And just seeing the things that those people go do after we are no longer working closely together just fills me with joy.
Yes, yes.
And so just knowing that I kind of don't care what everybody thinks of me, but like having those people that I've like worked with, like feel like, you know, hey, it wasn't a waste of time working with Kevin Scott. Like I like that, that's what I would like. And like, obviously, like I care a lot about what my family thinks. Like I want to, I want to support them in their ambitions and dreams, and, you know, like have my wife be successful and my children be successful and, you know, do good things in the world, and believe that, you know, they had a husband and a father who supported them being their best selves.
That was such a wonderfully enriching conversation and a great way to end a podcast. He's so thoughtful and engaged with the world around him and with the innovation process. Use responsibly AI can transform the world for good, driving much-needed social and environmental innovation at scale. As Kevin says, these are really exciting times. Thank you so much, Kevin. I enjoyed tremendously, of course, our partnership in the company, but also as a friend in this podcast. You've been incredible. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, and thanks for putting positive energy out into the world.
Thank you, Kevin. I'm Jean-Philippe Courtois. You've been listening to the Positive Leadership Podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, then please leave us a comment or 5-star rating. And if you like more practical tips on how to develop your positive leadership, then head over to my LinkedIn page and sign up for my free monthly newsletter, Positive Leadership and You. Thanks so much for listening. Goodbye.